The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Ginsburg, Stevens, and Souter, and Justice O'Connor. What was surprising was the addition to the anti-choice side of Justice Kennedy. Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas, as you would expect, since they dissented from Casey and said Roe should be overturned, you could pretty much picture where they were going to end up on this issue. But Kennedy joined them in dissent and would have upheld the Nebraska statute, despite its lack of a health exception and despite how early in pregnancy it reached. That was surprising to most observers and troubling, obviously, as he was one of the authors of the Casey decision. And what it meant was that Justice O'Connor cast the deciding vote. So in a 5-4 decision, she has the deciding vote. She writes a separate concurrence that says, if this were limited to just one procedure, DNX, which is the procedure that now the government claims they are targeting with this definition, if it were limited to the one procedure, and if it had an exception to protect women's health, I would find it constitutional. And what that means, since she's casting the deciding vote, is that if a state did that, that would succeed at the Supreme Court level because she would be then the fifth vote to uphold. Exactly zero states took her up on that. Actually, subsequent to the Stenberg decision, a couple of the states went ahead and just reenacted bans without health exceptions. Those have, of course, been enjoined. And then the federal ban came subsequent to Stenberg. So what Congress did after the Stenberg decision is not to go in and enact a ban that complied with Justice O'Connor's concurrence, but instead enacted a ban that was basically very similar to the ban that had been struck down, the Nebraska ban, and that decision obviously made all the similar bans in the states unconstitutional and unenforceable. They added a section of congressional findings, and I'll put that in air quotes, Britney Spears air quotes, because they wanted to get around the requirement of the Supreme Court that there be a health exception, so they added in a section of findings saying that despite the Supreme Court's finding that there was a reasonable amount of debate in the medical community about the necessity and that there were some women for whom this was the safest procedure, despite the Supreme Court finding that, Congress found differently, and that there was therefore no necessity for a health exception. And I'm sure Helene will get more into the details of the findings and what's before the court right now. But basically, there was this clear path from O'Connor and her concurrence in terms of, if you do this, I will uphold it, and Congress did not do that. And that was even before Justice O'Connor was replaced on the court by Justice Alito. That being, of course, probably the most troubling thing to the pro-choice community is that what we're facing now on the court is that Justice O'Connor, who did cast the deciding vote, has been replaced by Justice Alito, who has a rather troubling anti-choice history, and there is reason to be concerned that he would vote quite differently from O'Connor. So in the meantime, as I said, a couple of other states enacted similar bans. Again, there has not been a lot of subsequent activity in the states because for the first time, Congress stepped in to ban abortion. That's the first time that Congress has done that. It obviously trumps any protections that are in place in the states. A number of states now have additional state constitutional protection for a woman's right to choose that exceeds that of the federal constitution. Some of them have codified Roe into their statutes so that Roe's protections are in place. The federal ban, if it's upheld, would trump all of that, would impose this restriction in states that had chosen not to enact it, in fact, would impose it in states under which, if it were a state law, it would be struck down under their state constitution. So this is a troubling expansion at the federal level and unprecedented in a lot of ways. So Stenberg and then the enactment of the federal ban, and I think that I turn that over to you two in terms of what's going on now.
Mm-hmm. As they introduced me, I'm Helene Krasnoff, and I'm an attorney with Planned Parenthood, and I have been on the trial team from the beginning of one of the three lawsuits that were brought challenging the ban. So in 2003, Congress enacted the ban, and on the eve of the signing in very late October, three separate lawsuits were brought in three district courts challenging the ban. They were all filed at the same time. The Planned Parenthood case was filed in the Northern District of California on behalf of Planned Parenthood Golden Gate and all Planned Parenthood affiliates who perform second trimester abortions. The National Abortion Federation and several individual doctors sued in the Southern District of New York, and they're represented by the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project. And Dr. Carhart, the lead plaintiff in Stenberg versus Carhart, along with three other physicians, sued again in the district court in Nebraska, which is where Stenberg had come out of. All three district courts granted immediate temporary restraining orders. All three courts, sort of on the request of the Justice Department and our consent, consolidated these for trials on preliminary and permanent injunction, or I guess agreed to a preliminary injunction and a fast track to a trial. And in March of 2004, all three on the same day, three consecutive trials opened on the same law in three different district courts throughout the country. All three district courts heard from numerous doctors who perform second trimester abortions that would be banned by the act, and also by pretty much the same group of government witnesses. There's some overlap in the plaintiff's witnesses too, but they heard trials that lasted from 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and the New York trial went on and on. I think it was like 4.5 weeks or something, but they had a lot of days off. And all three district courts sometime later that year all ruled the same thing. They all struck down the law as unconstitutional. And they did so, all three held two things in common, completely the same, which is they all said the law is unconstitutional because it lacks a health exception, and they all said that under Stenberg, when there's substantial medical authority that says that banning this procedure will increase risk to women's health, then there needs to be a health exception. Substantial medical authority was the sort of test that Justice Breyer laid out in Stenberg, and that the evidence that everyone found was stronger than it was in Stenberg, that there was substantial medical authority supporting the proposition that banning intact DNA would risk women's health. The second thing that's important that they all found is they all looked at the congressional findings, because the government's big argument of how to get around Stenberg was this district court in Nebraska was hamstrung by the Supreme Court in Stenberg was hamstrung because it just had the findings of this one little district court in Nebraska who had a two-day trial, and we of Congress have heard so much more evidence, and the court's roles are to defer to Congress, especially on disputed issues, and so we can find that this is never medically necessary. And not only did the courts say, no, the legal standard is it medically necessary? Is there substantial medical authority? They said even if we were going to, you know, sort of roll over and defer to Congress, Congress's findings are just inherently unreasonable. They're unreasonable based on the record before Congress, Congress's own record. Congress just, you know, they invited who they wanted to hearings. They ignored the other evidence in the record. They made findings, actually, this is, of course, how legislation is drafted. The findings were drafted before any new hearings post-Stenberg. And the court said, you know, these findings are just simply unreasonable. And one example that's gotten a lot of press since now, and it's an important one, but it's gotten some press since the argument, is Congress found that intact DNA is a disfavored procedure that's not taught at any medical schools. And what the trial witnesses were not some, you know, marginal group of obstetricians and gynecologists. They come from NYU, Cornell, University of Chicago, Northwestern, University of California at San Francisco, University of Pittsburgh, Albert Einstein in Philadelphia. It was, you know, it's a litany of the, like, leading medical schools, and all of them testified that they perform and teach these procedures at these leading medical schools. And so in the face of these sort of congressional findings, these courts said, you know, these findings are just inherently unreasonable. The district court in California, our case, also ruled that the New York said, it doesn't have a health exception, I don't need to look any further. It's unconstitutional. The district court in California went further and said, also like in Stenberg, the ban is so imprecisely worded that it would ban virtually all second trimester abortions because the physician, when starting out performing what is referred to as a D&E, which is the most common, 85 to 95% of all abortions after the first trimester and 95% in the second trimester are performed by D&E. Now, when a physician sets out to perform a D&E, any abortion could run afoul of the definition of partial birth abortion in the law, and that is an undue burden on a woman's right to choose. The Nebraska court found that as well, although he based it a little bit on the intent of Dr. Carhart and how he does procedures. It was a little bit of a little murky ruling, and it's going to sort of drop out a little bit anyway as we go up. So the government appealed all three. Now, in California also ruled the law, if it doesn't ban all D&Es, is unconstitutionally vague. So the court in California reached all the issues in the Planned Parenthood case. The government appealed all three cases. The Second, Ninth, and Eighth Circuit all found that the ban was unconstitutional. They all found it was unconstitutional because it lacked a health exception. The Second and Eighth Circuits, they stopped there. The Ninth Circuit went further and ruled on all the grounds the California court had ruled and said it's also unconstitutional because it reaches D&E. And it also is unconstitutionally vague. Now, how they got to the Supreme Court and how there were two cases at the Supreme Court is sort of interesting, confusing, and irrelevant, sort of all at the same time. So I'll try and do it as quickly as I can. But last term, the Supreme Court handed out a decision called Ayotte versus Planned Parenthood of Northern New Hampshire that dealt with what the appropriate remedy is. If a law is unconstitutional, do they strike the whole law or do they only take down a piece of it? So the Second Circuit said, we don't know what to do with this law without a health exception after Ayotte, and we want the parties to brief that and look at that, and then we'll decide after what to do. So that case kind of wasn't ready to go to the Supreme Court. The Justice Department asked for the Eighth Circuit opinion to go up, and the court last February said they were going to hear it. The Planned Parenthood case, they asked the court to grant cert, but then hold the case, don't consider the Planned Parenthood case, and just issue a ruling based on whatever happens in the Eighth Circuit case, but only consider the Eighth Circuit case. We said, no, if you're going to grant, you shouldn't have granted cert in any of these, because there's no issue here, but if you're going to grant cert, consider our case too, because our case addressed all these issues. It had the undue burden, it had the vagueness, and in fact, the Eighth Circuit also dealt with a remedy after Ayotte. So we said, ours is the most full, take ours. And they said, okay, we'll take yours too. They didn't consolidate the cases, which is also sort of unusual. They heard them what's called in tandem. And the reason they heard them in tandem, I think, although I don't know, is that the Eighth Circuit, the Center for Reproductive Rights case, the Carhart case, was already being briefed by the time cert was granted in Planned Parenthood. So they were on a staggered briefing schedule, so they had separate briefing. And then on November 8th, argument was heard in both of them, but they were heard, like I said, in tandem, which meant an individual hour for each case. So the government argued twice. It was, Solicitor General Clement, Priscilla Smith from the Center for Reproductive Rights, rebuttal from Clement again in the Planned Parenthood case, my colleague Eve Gartner for Planned Parenthood, Clement rebuttal. And this has happened before. In the University of Michigan, the Grutter versus Bollinger, the affirmative action cases were heard this way two terms ago now. So it has happened before. It's not unprecedented, but it was a very long, robust argument. And so what happened at the argument? What we argued, of course, was the same things we argued below, which is lack of a health exception, substantial medical authority shows this is would harm women's health, it's drafted so broadly as it could reach all second trimester D&Es. If it doesn't reach D&Es, it's vague. There's no need for you to defer to Congress's findings, and even if you did defer to them, they're simply unreasonable, as all the courts said. And the government did say, of course, if we don't win under Stenberg, you should overrule Stenberg. And we, of course, argued that for purposes of stare decisis, as well as the fact that it was just right, that they should not overrule Stenberg. And so what happened at the court and what's the court going to do, I can try and editorialize a little bit. Of course, we don't really know. But, certainly all eyes were on Justice Kennedy. One thing Belinda highlighted that he had been in the plurality in Casey but dissented in Stenberg. And what she didn't say about his dissent is it was vehement. It was not I don't think this is what Casey replies. It was, if Casey doesn't mean that this gruesome, horrible thing can be banned, then I don't know what it means, and this is a betrayal of Casey. And he was really, I wasn't there the day they handed down the opinion, but, they read from the bench, this sort of theater thing when they come, and when he read his dissent, people were saying there were, veins throbbing in his neck and his head, and, he really believed very strongly. So going in, there's only three people that we could be talking to, right? And we don't think that Stevens, Breyer, Souter, or Ginsburg are going to move, and we certainly don't think that Thomas or Scalia are going to move. So that leaves, that only leaves Roberts, Alito, and Kennedy. Most people have just assumed that Alito, I think, is a lost cause. I think that's the sort of thought. So then that leaves Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy, and interestingly, at the argument, Justice Alito is the only person on the bench who asked no questions whatsoever during the 2 hours. He didn't say a thing.
Except for Thomas.
Well, Thomas was absent. He was sick, but he will participate in the decision. So, Don't worry about that. And so, and you know, everyone else participated a fair amount. The bench in general was very friendly to both sides. It was not a very aggressive bench. Scalia actually was quite quiet for Scalia. I don't know. You know, again, there's all sorts of theories of why everyone acts the way they do on the bench, and, you know, we'll never know what goes on in their conferences, let alone their heads of, you know, in advance. I mean, some people think, you know, Scalia knows he has to get Kennedy too, right, or Roberts, and that he wanted, that his tone of antagonizing the plaintiffs doesn't really help get them necessarily. That's one theory. You know, who knows? No one will ever know what happens. This is like, you know, all sort of speculation. But what was interesting is that Justice Kennedy was very calm, very interested. He certainly didn't display any hand of the vehemence from his Stenberg dissent. And he also, in particular places, asked really specific questions about women's health and about the record that, you know, suggest, and no one knows, again, where he'll come out, but suggest that he is at least potentially open to reconsidering his Stenberg dissent. I mean, we again, no one knows. But he asked things like, he asked the government's witness about a specific example in the record of a woman who has a certain kind of uterine cancer where additional instrumentation in the uterus would be particularly dangerous, which is why having an intact procedure, what the government says is banned, would be beneficial to her. And the fact that he had, you know, taken on the record and thought about those circumstances, that's certainly a good sign. Justice Roberts asked a lot of questions also. Justice Roberts' questions were more focused on statutory construction, which are the government's sort of arguments of why this ban is different from, it doesn't really address the health exception issue, to be quite honest. It's a, it addresses the breadth of it and whether it bans only intact D&E or all, could reach all D&Es. He kind of was just adopting the government's position and asking those questions, and, you know, maybe that's because that's where he wants to go, or maybe he was just test driving them, and, you know, it's hard to say. So, what they're going to do, I mean, you know, the court could do lots of things. They could say, we could just agree it's bound by Stenberg, and they could do what all the other courts have done. They could, do what the government's asking them to do, which is to uphold the ban, but also not overrule Stenberg and say that this is different somehow. I think that would be, that could be an okay, it could not be an okay scenario sort of for the law. It could potentially be a better scenario than simply overruling Stenberg in practice. Depending on how many abortions the ban really, you know, they ultimately reach. Then they could also just simply overrule Stenberg. And overruling Stenberg, just sort of, I think you'd asked to talk a little bit about what sort of this means for the law and what this means for the law. Belinda said this, is it's not 1-5-4 hotly contested decision about some rare procedure, which is how people want to play it and how if they overrule it, they're going to want to play it. What it is 30 years of abortion jurisprudence that says whenever women's health is regulated, whenever abortion is regulated, women's health always must be paramount consideration. And we never, regardless of the state interest, trade off women's health. And one thing, just to sort of advocate on behalf of Justice Breyer, as he advocated on the bench in behalf of the Stenberg opinion, and this is a little, like, overly lawyerly, but you're a law student, so I'll try it out, is that is if you think about the substantial medical authority test, it really is brilliant. Because what he's not saying Congress can't ever ban something. If something were truly outside of the mainstream or dangerous, if you couldn't garner substantial medical authority that believed it brought safety risks, then go ahead and ban it, and that's fine. It's not saying if one doctor stands up and says, oh, we need this, that then you have to overrule entire statutes. And that's how the other side plays this. And that's a little bit actually how Justice Kennedy's dissent reads in Stenberg, is that's what he thought the majority was saying. But if you really read Stenberg, Justice Breyer, that's not what he says. He says, in the face of substantial medical authority, when there is substantial medical authority, and I want to point out both in Stenberg and here, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is 90% of all practicing obstetricians and gynecologists, also believe that there would be safety, that there are instances where the ban procedure would be the safest for women's health. So just sort of when people sort of say, what people will say is, oh, you need a health exception. Every abortion regulation needs a health exception. And that's true, but it's a lot more nuanced than that. And when you're talking about banning pre-viability abortions, in some ways, Stenberg already was a cutback, even on Casey and certainly on Roe, because what Stenberg says, in some ways, if you read O'Connor's opinion, is there is this small class of pre-viability abortions, if you define it carefully and you have a health exception, that you can ban. There's this small class you can ban. So in some ways, while Stenberg was a great victory for us, it was, in theory, a little bit of a loss. So it was the first time the court said this. But there's also, you know, to some extent, sort of a brilliance to the substantial medical authority test and to Justice Breyer's opinion. And he was certainly on the bench actually sort of advocating for his test in a certain way. You know, he was sort of saying, well, I've read all these records, and I've read the testimony of every one of these 14 doctors, and isn't it true there's greater support here than there was in Stenberg that this would harm women? You know, he was sort of, they weren't just softballs for our side. They were really defending his, I think he was really, you know, they talked to each other on the bench. That's a lot of what they're doing, and I think he was defending his own opinion to some extent. So, you know, we want to take questions and see what you're interested in. Oh, one last thing I will say is the court, and not, I don't think that surprisingly, was not very interested in the deference to congressional findings issue, just on an institutional sort of competence level. I don't think anybody thought that the court in general or this court was going to sort of turn over and just roll over to Congress and say, that's right, Congress found it. So that's a whole different, we don't have to assess the constitutionality because Congress found it. And, you know, a little just side note about that, which is funny, is just that this was, of course, the morning after the election. So that might go on both sides of everybody on the court could have thought, I don't want to roll over to this past Congress, and I don't want to roll over to this new Congress. So it's just a sort of institutional confidence level. I don't think that the notion that because Congress found it, you can ban it, has a whole lot of traction with this court, or at least I would think not. So.
Sorry to jump in. Gretchen's going to talk about amicus briefs, and I just want to say, Colleen is entirely right that I forgot to mention what I normally do when I'm talking about this, which is Kennedy's opinion, and you covered it, but I will say, if for those of you who haven't read Stenberg, if you do read it, or if you just read his opinion, if you didn't know it was a Kennedy opinion, you would probably think it was Scalia or Thomas. It's that bad. He uses it, or good, depending on your, that's passionate. I mean, he uses the term abortionist to refer to MDs. He uses the word infanticide. It's a very strong, passionate decision, and that's what I think it sounds like from people who read the arguments, that there was some, I wouldn't say surprise, but pleasant surprise at least, that Kennedy did seem to be very engaged in that discussion with respect to women's health, and he has a lot more of a record before him now. There was certainly a sufficient one in December, but he has much more before him now. So, sorry. And now, Gretchen.
I'm just going to briefly cover some of the amicus briefs that were submitted, because I think it's pretty interesting to think about the strategy and what people are trying to achieve and some of the really good amicus briefs that came out of it. I think Colleen and Belinda have covered everything else I was going to mention, so we really do want to get to questions, so I'll try to be quick about this. So I don't know if all you know, but amicus briefs are very influential, it seems, lately with the court. And Colleen had mentioned the two affirmative action cases a couple of years ago, and in that case in particular, the court really did look at the amicus briefs, in particular the military and the business community, who wrote in support of affirmative action. And that seemed to be a huge factor in the court's decision to, you know, say affirmative action can continue to be used and does have valuable contribution to our society. So in the years since then, and even before then, but I think even more so, the amicus brief strategy has become more well-coordinated and more strategic in trying to appeal to the justices on certain angles. So I'm just going to talk about some of the reasons people file amicus briefs and then give some examples of some that were submitted in this case for those purposes. So one reason you'd want to file an amicus brief is to kind of delve into some of the legal issues that the main parties aren't able to cover fully in their brief. And NARAL's brief, which Belinda can talk more about if you have more questions, is a great example of that. So they really went into the whole Ayotte question that Helene mentioned, right? So when you find a law to be unconstitutional, Ayotte said, look at whether you can kind of make it constitutional perhaps by rewriting the statute or doing something else, giving a narrowing construction. And one way the court said to do that is look at legislative intent of Congress or the state legislature. And the NARAL's brief did a really good job of saying not only is that an inappropriate role for the judiciary to rewrite statutes, but also in this case in particular, it's so clear that Congress did not want a health exception, if that's one of the remedies that you could think of, did not want a health exception, that it would be beyond, you know, just violate congressional intent to rewrite the statute to have a health exception in it. So they did a really good job of kind of going into more depth on that issue. And then they also looked at the question of facial challenges to abortion statutes, which is something that came up in the AOT decision and has come up, I think, only in Carhartt this time. The government
dropped it in the PPS.
Yeah, they were trying to change the way you can facially challenge an abortion statute to make it very, very difficult to do so. And so the NARAL brief went into that in more detail as well and why that was going to be so bad. So that was an example of an amicus brief that was really focused on kind of getting more into something that the main party briefs weren't able to cover in more depth. Of course, it's always important for amicus briefs to have some kind of authority to back up some of the arguments that you're making. One good example of that is the ACOG brief, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which Helene mentioned. And they did a really fantastic amicus brief that laid out why this ban was so bad, why it would chill physicians from providing any type of second trimester abortions, why there are significant safety advantages to the procedure, why it was so important that women have this procedure and that doctors have this procedure available to them. And then there was also a really interesting brief filed by former federal prosecutors who went into more detail on why the ban was so unconstitutionally vague and overbroad and how that would actually negatively impact the criminal justice system. And actually, they said undermine the integrity of the criminal justice system. So those are two good examples of, you know, different kinds of authorities backing up some of the arguments that the parties made in their briefs. Other briefs try to point out just different aspects that the court may not consider. So the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice is a good example of that. They did an amicus brief that talked about how religions view abortion differently. Not all of them are opposed to it, and in fact, some actually mandate that a woman whose health is at risk should get an abortion and that they place primacy on the woman over the fetus. And they actually went on to say that it could be a violation of an individual woman's religious freedom, this ban in mandating that she decide to, you know, choose a certain way, that they're imposing a view of morality on this woman. So that's a good example of that kind of reason to use an amicus brief. Something that we tried to do, and some other briefs tried to do, was to point out the real-world impact of this ban and the law on people's lives. So we, in our amicus brief, looked at the real consequences, not only to women's health, but to women's financial security and to their economic opportunity and their well-being in society if they're not able to access the safest health care for them. So we looked beyond just immediate health consequences to kind of longer-term consequences, not only to their health, but to their lives and to their families' lives as well. And that was signed on. We had 31 additional sign-ons from organizations that are committed to safe health care for women. And then another great brief that I recommend that you all read was what's called the Women's Stories Brief. And that was a brief that collected stories of over 150 different women who have had second trimester abortions. Not all of whom had the supposedly banned procedure, but women who had any type of second trimester abortion, who talked about the reasons why they chose to have an abortion. And not surprisingly, those were three different categories: so fetal anomalies, threat to women's health, their own health, or because of delays, sometimes financial, sometimes geographic, sometimes abortion restrictions that are in place that force women later into their pregnancies to decide what to do. So it's a really emotional brief. It kind of hits you, you know, in the heart, and it's told from these women's point of view. So hopefully that will have some impact. We'll have to wait to see. And then finally, of course, the brief as trying to get at individual justices. So as you can imagine, as we heard in this case, Kennedy, everyone was considering to be the swing vote. So everyone tried to write to Kennedy, and we in our brief are guilty of that, or smartly did that. In one section where we talked about women's dignity, we were quoting Kennedy's decision in Lawrence v. Texas back to him as much as possible, and I think those quotes were used over and over and over again. And then also the Cato Institute actually wrote a really interesting brief that was trying to get at the justices who believe in states' rights. And they really went into the fact that regulating medicine has really been a prerogative of the states. It has not been a traditional function of Congress to regulate medicine in any way. So everyone thinks that may have some influence, although when Justice Ginsburg brought it up at oral arguments, Scalia, in one of his few comments, he made a couple of sarcastic comments, shot her down and said, well, the federal government got involved in abortion in Casey, so I don't know what you're talking about. So I don't know how much influence we'll have, but maybe with Alito or Roberts, it'll do something. So anyway, just very quickly, that was some of the amicus briefs, and they're all available on the Federal Abortion Ban website, which is just federalabortionban.org. So if you want to go there and check some of them out, I recommend that.
And the
and the transcripts of the oral argument are available on the Supreme Court's website as well, if you want to see what happened at the argument. And I don't know, C-SPAN, you know, did rebroadcast them. I don't know if they're just available.
The audio is on the website, but the link is messed up right now.
Okay.
But it is on there. On their Supreme Court page, you can get an MP3 of the argument.
Well, thank you so much for that outline. We're going to open it up to questions right now.
I didn't sort of open, Belinda did, but I do a little sort of, you know, myth and fact thing about what people talk about with respect to this, and one of the, you know, the great myths is that there is sort of a banned procedure. Intact D&E is a recognized procedure. The ban is not limited to the definition of intact D&E, and in fact, I think the justices tried to answer this question too, which everyone tries to ask about. There's certainly no way to know what is banned by this law, but in terms of intact D&E, which is the alleged ban procedure versus D&E, there are no statistics kept about when procedures are performed that way. The CDC and the states ask for categories, and the category is D&E, which covers intact as well as non-intact extraction during a D&E. And so the only data is how many D&Es are performed. You know, the methods generally available in the second trimester are induction of labor, which is usually not done before 16 weeks, and D&E, or surgical abortion, D&E having different variants. And so there is no data at all about whether or not a D&E is performed with intact extraction or not. Well, ACOG doesn't keep any data. The only data that's kept on abortion is, there's a voluntary data that's done through the Alan Guttmacher Institute, and they're known to be actually the most reliable data on abortion statistics, even though it's a voluntary report by abortion providers. The CDC also keeps data, but of the states that require reporting, but all of the states don't require reporting, so the CDC's data is not complete. I think that the real hard part, if you talk to the physicians, is, well, every physician talks about when they do an intact D&E a little bit different, about when they think they've achieved that result or not. And most interestingly, the decision whether or not to perform an intact D&E for most providers is an intraoperative decision, in that they dilate the woman's cervix the same way, and depending on basically what they find, they're going to, if possible, all the physicians testified, this is a lot of medicine, but all physicians testified that they always try to reduce instrumentation in the woman's uterus. When they do a D&E, has two steps, the dilation of the cervix and removal of the fetus. That's sort of the whole thing. And when they do, the dilation is completely variable. Each woman, depending on if they've had children or other aspects, will respond somewhat differently to the dilation. But regardless of what presents, they always try and remove the fetus as intact as possible, because every time that you insert instruments into a woman's uterus, you risk basically all of the major complications of D&E, which are perforating the woman's uterus, laceration to either her uterus or her cervix, which can result in hemorrhage. So all of the sort of the most grave complications of D&E happen basically because you're putting instruments into a woman's uterus. So all physicians try to extract the fetus as intact as possible. So in some cases, they are more successful or not at that, and the fetus may be removed more or less intact. So there is one study that was done that was available to the court now by Dr. Stephen Chasen, who's a plaintiff in the New York case, and he does make an intraoperative decision, but then he records afterwards whether he was able to perform what he calls an intact D&E versus a standard D&E. And so that is the first data and safety data available. And I don't know, and I'd have to ask a doctor, is a very long answer to your question, but I think it might be helpful in a political sense, because his study goes to be the first to show that at least that intact D&E, if not safer, then D&E is at least as safe. It's a small study. It only includes, I think, 368 abortions, something like that. But I think legally and politically it would be helpful. I don't know if physicians feel it's a huge advantage or not to have that data, but to the extent that he's trying to prove that it's a safer procedure, then I think that would be data physicians would want. So I'm not sure how that data would be collected, but I think everyone, even the government's witnesses, agreed that Dr. Chasen's study was a good first step in terms of studying intact D&E and figuring out, you know, sort of how and when it should be used, the way medicine develops. develops, and that's actually an interesting amicus brief. It was written by the American Medical Women's Association and a bunch of other medical groups about how medical practice develops and how new surgical techniques develop and how they don't develop in the face of, you know, legislation that tries to say you can, you know, move an instrument this way or not that way. But it's a really interesting brief that just talks about surgery and how variants in surgery develop and make procedures safer throughout time. That's a really interesting amicus brief also.
What we do know from Guttmacher, and I hope I know these numbers off the top of my head, but nearly 90% of abortions are performed in the first trimester. All but 1.5% are performed before the 20th week. So you're talking about a small percentage, but the cases are very compelling as the women's stories brief demonstrates.
12% of all abortions are performed after the first trimester. Of that, during the second trimester, 95% of them are performed by a surgical abortion, D&E, which would include intact and non-intact removal.
And intact D&E and DNX are the interchangeable
terms. Yeah, I should have said that.
I was just wondering what you think the likelihood of the court is to rule on a very narrow issue, whether it's a health exception or not, or if you think it's likely that it'll sort of go ahead and address the vagueness issue and also the deference issue and how comprehensive an opinion you think we can expect, or do you think it'll be as narrow as we can get by on making a...
I think that depends on if we win. I mean, I think if they agreed there was substantial medical authority and that we won on health, I don't see any reason that they would address. Although in Stenberg, they actually went ahead and addressed, and they said we're doing this for two independent reasons, and they went ahead and did that. So I think it's really hard to say how broad. I mean, they have to address health to some. They can't. They both, to the extent they're going to uphold the law, they have to address everything because they have to say it's okay for all these reasons, all the reasons we say it's not okay.
Particularly given Stenberg, right.
Right, and if they're going to strike down the law, they could do it for one reason and one reason only. I mean, they could say we're bound by stare decisis, you know, most of us hate this opinion, but we're not willing to go back on it. There could be three lines. I mean, I don't think anyone thinks that's what's going to happen, but it could be.
Talked about why that wouldn't really work at all. So those are the two ways they seem to
agree about in terms of enforceability, which is what an absolute nightmare in terms of being a prosecutor or a defense attorney. I mean, as a prosecutor going in, how on earth are you going to prove that, and how far beyond the appropriate scope of a criminal prosecutor for you to get into the business of what is going on for one procedure, for one woman, and one doctor? I mean, it's difficult enough when you have a much clearer fact pattern, you have a much less involved, situation, almost always outside of the medical sphere. It's just absolutely, on any number of sides, the effect is startling and really disturbing.
I don't think that's been discussed yet, as of, the change in the election. You know, a decision won't come down, obviously, before the new Congress, that's for sure. So, I don't know. I don't think if you counted votes in this Congress, just straight out votes, I don't think that the composition of the Congress is close enough change based on the vote on this bill to for a straight up, repeal of it. But I just can't imagine that. I don't think
the president. Law.
Right, well, of course. But I'm just saying, even beyond that,
that's what's happened in throughout the last decade or so in the states. These votes pulled in a lot of people whose votes were otherwise very good on the choice issue. And that's, the issue got so, there was so much misinformation and there was so much emotional appeal by the other side, I think, before our side really was able to come in with that. And so we lost people that otherwise tend to vote well on the issue. I think what is interesting, interesting is the wrong word. I need something more negative. But if, in fact, the ban's upheld, this will be the first time that these states, progressive states, especially ones that have codified Roe or that have state constitutional protection, won't be able to basically make better what Congress has done. With the Hyde Amendment, with public funding restrictions, states can come in with their state Medicaid funding and provide funding so that low-income women aren't discriminated against with abortion funding. With gag rules, other things, states are able to come in with their own funds because that's how most of the restrictions have been done in the past, is through funding. And this will be the first time, if in fact the ban's upheld, that states can't get around it. And in talking to folks in the states, that is, it's jarring to them, and it's unexpected, and it will be a complete chaos in the states if this happens, because they really are accustomed to being able to overcome the bad things that Congress does. And this is, I've had many conversations where people go, but how is this possible? And I go, well, it's constitutional, but how is this possible? It's the Supremacy Clause. I don't know what to tell you, So it could really throw a lot of things into chaos in the states.
Is everyone here that you, Melinda, have done a lot of writing about Justice Roberts?
Oh, yeah.
just quickly, do you have any ideas or approaches about which way he might be going?
Probably what's on there is NARAL did a lot, and our department did a lot during the nomination process and the confirmation hearings of Roberts. I think what Helene said is probably what I would say, which is that of Alito or Roberts, I would be more likely to say that Alito would go the wrong way on this. I think both of them, their records would clearly indicate that they're not going to be in the right place on the choice issue. That said, Chief Justice Roberts said a lot during his confirmation hearings about, wanting to be an an umpire and not, what is it? I always get my sports metaphors. But something about, not wanting to make a lot. He wanted to have, and he said since, that he likes unanimous opinions, he likes, agreement on the court, he likes narrow decisions, only decide what has to be decided.
And if and modest wants a modest court, wants to be a modest justice, a modest court is not going to uphold this ban. A modest court is not going to uphold to overturn Stenberg. The modest thing to do, the thing that would be consistent with stare decisis, another thing to which Justice Roberts spent a lot of time paying a lot of tribute to during his confirmation hearings, the thing to do is to uphold Stenberg by striking down the ban. I don't have a crystal ball to know whether or not he's going to do that. His writings about Roe being wrongly decided, clearly troubling with respect to that. But, you know, we'll see.
You're overstating things.
Absolutely not. You know, this we had 14 states considering almost total bans on abortion last year. South Dakota enacted one. Louisiana enacted one that would take effect if Roe falls. Georgia just pre-filed one for the next session. And the penalty is death or life in prison, and it applies to contraception as well. This is not, it's not an isolated incident. This is an overall political strategy. The founder of Operation Rescue has actually said about these laws, it was a public relations gold mine that would have almost no practical effect. And so they'll concede that. It's been very good for the other side. But I think that the tide is turning, and I think that the agenda has really been exposed in the past few years. And I do agree with Talene that the coverage has gotten better. They still use the term partial birth, but they'll say a procedure that opponents call, so at least we've gotten to that point. And it's a little more balanced, and the talk is about women's health in a lot of the articles, which before, I mean, if you look at some of the media coverage from the mid to late 90s when these bans were first around, you just don't see women hardly mentioned at all.
And one other thing sort of into the cocktail party conversation or things that have sort of turned people's opinion more besides the larger agenda of anti-abortion has been just and especially with the previous Congress, the now soon to be gone Congress, is Congress playing doctor, and that really people really, really, really thought Congress overreached in the Terri Schiavo situation, and that Congress being involved in personal medical decisions has also been another lens, is what our media people call it, but another lens that really helps turn people's views. Besides the larger agenda to ban abortion, is to talk about it in terms of a lens of, like, doctors say this is best, but Congress is saying, basically finding it's not best, because that's what now Congress seems to think, that, you know, Bill Frist standing up there diagnosing by videotape, that that's, you know, the best thing to do. So that's been another, you know, helpful strategy in terms of just talking about this to people who, you know, we're not going to sit and explain how abortion's procedures are performed and why this bans too much, like I do when I talk to people about it.
I think that what the focus has been on the last few years is not only to enact policy that helps women, especially helps women prevent unintended pregnancies and therefore the need for abortion, but also to make sure that the debate is on the right terms, and that is that when you're talking about a woman's right to choose, that you understand that it is a full scope, that it's about comprehensive sex ed, access to family planning, wider access to contraception, and making sure that abortion stays safe and legal. I know every time I talk about choice, I always make sure that abortion staying safe and legal is there. Certainly in the states, much of the debate, focuses on that because that's where most of the restrictions are aimed. But I think that to the extent that you've seen a shift to pro-choice measures and to prevention measures, that's been directed at attacks from the right, actually, on things as basic as sex ed and contraception, but also on really wanting to ensure that that policy and that law reflects that the pro-choice movement is concerned about reducing the need for abortion in whatever way we can. And so, at least for me, I haven't seen people shy away from it in our movement. It may be that not people in the movement necessarily, but it may be that you don't hear it as much from people, elected officials and things like that. But I think that's changing too. And I think that the more we can reclaim what pro-choice means, the more we can talk about the whole.